Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. The 17th century Boston preacher Cotton Mather is today remembered, in those rare moments when he is, as something akin to the Grand Inquisitor of the Salem witch trials. Alternatively, but not exclusively, he is seen as a pious, pompous humbug, the last breath of hot air from the lungs of a dying Puritan New England. But who was the real Cotton Mather? What was his historical and cultural importance? And how is his changing image over the intervening centuries a study in the alterations of historical memory, of how we write history to satisfy ourselves? With me to discuss Cotton Mather, his life and times and legacy, is Dr. Rick Kennedy. He's the author of The First American Evangelical, A Short Life of Cotton Mather, which is published in the Library of Religious Biography by William B. Erdmans. Professor of History at Point Loma Nazarene College, Dr. Kennedy is also part of a team of editors in both Germany and America, preparing the 10 volumes of Cotton Mather's unpublished Biblia Americana. Rick Kennedy, you have said that Cotton Mather is very much at the center of most everything going on intellectually and spiritually in colonial New England, and that's quite a mouthful. Before I ask you what you mean by that, let's review the basic facts of Cotton Mather's life. When is he born? When does he die? And sort of what are the points in between?
Yeah. Cotton Mather, a lot of what makes Cotton Mather just amazing is his situation. So he's born 1663, dies 1728, which is just an amazing transitional time in the British Empire under William and Mary and such, and all that goes around that. And then also it's his situation in the north end of Boston, a little neighborhood, tiny, wonderful neighborhood to visit with the Freedom Trail and stuff there now.
It really is,
but,
yeah.
But it was the most dynamic spot in all of British Empire, outside of like London and such, and it was just this amazing spot. So Cotton Mather, along with his father and also his grandfather, the Mather family were this core family sitting right at the right spot at the right time to be hugely influential in so many things. And every historian has to deal with them, and you find them dealing in the history of medicine. Cotton Mather is like the founder of American medicine. You deal with the legal stuff of the witch trials and, you know, evidentiary stuff, and Cotton Mather and his father Increase are all on that. All of the doctrinal stuff, all of the Puritan evangelical stuff all comes up with them. And then, of course, politics. Is they're right at the center. Cotton and his father were at the center of this sort of like a side revolution, which was part of the Glorious Revolution of England in 1688. And what happens is that his father has to get snuck out of Boston to go to England as an ambassador, and so Cotton actually becomes he's illegal. These are sneaking people. The governor is trying to stop them. They are avoiding the sheriff. They are sneaking people, doing all sorts of subterfuge. And then when the governor is finally arrested, and they actually arrest also a captain of a British ship. And Boston is overthrowing this is like American Revolution stuff 100 years before the American Revolution.
Yeah,
and Cotton Mather plays the role of the Thomas Jefferson. He's the guy who writes all up what's going on. He's the one who articulates what this is about. It's about freedom. It's about taxation. It's about what it means to be a British citizen. I mean, it's really amazing stuff. And so politics, religion, and then science. These are the guys who are right at the center of politics. popularizing science. Now, Increase and his son Cotton are not the most brilliant scientists, but what they are these people who see that science is this hugely important thing that needs to be promoted. And so, you just keep going down the list, and Cotton's right at the center of it all.
So that's great. A great taste of what we'll be getting into. Who's his grandfather, or I should say grandfathers? You mentioned the grandfather and the father. Let's work forward from the grandfathers.
Okay, there's Richard Mather, and then there's John Cotton, and these are two of the most important thinkers of the first generation of the Puritans who came from England over to Boston. And then Richard Mather's son, Increase Mather, married John Cotton's daughter, Maria. And so you have Cotton Mather is named, he's the daughter, he's the son of Maria Mather and Increase Mather, and so he is then named Cotton Mather.
So he is from a royal line of preachers, just to mix the metaphors.
A line of preachers that are hugely respected, and there's also a bunch of uncles and brothers and stuff to Increase Mather that are involved, but they were not just pious and respected for wisdom, they were also respected for intellect, and these are the guys who brought over to America a standard of belief in education. The reading of the Bible was so important, and the thinking deeply and understanding things so important that they set up a school systems throughout New England, and they demanded that children be educated. And then so what you have is the sort of the whole package of Protestantism in a very deep and powerful way being infused into New England, and at the center of it is John Cotton and Richard Mather, and then the Increase Mather represents the second generation of that. Cotton Mather represents the third generation.
Increase Mather lived for a very long time. I forget, Cotton lived in his father's, I don't want to say his father's shadow, because what's interesting about him, it's always seemed to me, is that he became a famous and sort of weighty figure, even though his father was also a very famous, very prominent figure at the same time. Speak about Increase Mather a little bit.
Increase Mather's amazingly powerful. He is a visionary who sees that the Puritan ideas of his father's generation can be held together into this new world of the British Empire that's being created after the charters are messed up and they have to redesign everything. Harvard is falling apart. They beg Increase Mather to be in charge of Harvard, and he does. He takes over Harvard and he tries to hold it together. He saves Harvard, and then he wants to build a new charter for the politics of the place in Boston. And he does write the new charter, and he gets it. And he is the one who gets to pick the first of the governors that come, the Phipps. And so, he's just an amazing figure. And when you read Increase Mather, the depth and power of his thought is, I think, much more evident than with Cotton. Cotton is an evangelical in many ways, and he's a little softer, he's a little more fun, he's a little more interesting, but it's his father who's much deeper and, Increase Mather is amazing.
So we've got Dad. We've got the legacy of his grandfathers, the first Puritan preachers of Massachusetts Bay Colony. You referred to several important events. Let's walk through those. They occur in roughly one after the other. So first would be the Halfway Covenant controversy, I believe, which is very obscure to modern people, but was of extraordinary importance to New Englanders of the 1670s, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's more increases this issue, because cotton really is, he's much more soft on that.
Yeah, it lays the groundwork, though, for cotton's life in many ways. It
lays the groundwork. I mean, the halfway covenant is a church membership is the foundation of political citizenship, and also it's the foundation of sort of being part of what this city on a hill, this Puritan New England, is supposed to be all about. And so who gets to be a member is crucial, and so especially when you get into the second and third generation. And so the halfway covenant is it's a compromise. It's just what it is. It's a compromise to let, you know, children of members become halfway members, even though they haven't had the sort of conversion experience.
So this increase is, as I recall, actually I just read up on it again, increase is partial to this. It's actually the members often who are not. Is that right?
Yeah, you know,
it's a confusing situation.
Hey, and here's the deal. Okay, you're actually asking the wrong guy on this, because I have never in all of my career bought into why it's that important. I'm one of the few, maybe the very few, that really don't see this church issue to be so important. I was my dissertation long ago was on the Brattles and the Brattle Street Church and its issues about membership and things like this. And frankly, what you just said is so important, is that the congregations were not too worried. There were some very key ministers that were worried. Richard Mather was very worried. Increase Mather was very worried. But most people handled it quite well. So I don't see it as a crisis. The real crisis is when the charter gets revoked by the king in England. And then they have no... You know, all of their land ownership is dependent upon the Charter of Massachusetts, but that charter's been revoked.
And what year is that?
What? It's sort of a process. It begins around 1684, and then really by 1686, it's the new governors arrived, and there's this is what leads in to the witch trials. This is one of these crucial things of the 80s, beginning almost back into the 70s when they're talking about reforming and figuring out how to, you know, when the Charles II had come back after the Puritan interregnum after 1660. So there's this slow anxiety that just keeps building, because who are we going to get to keep our landownings? Are we going to keep our churches? Is a bishop going to get sent over here? And are they going to take away our college? And are they going to tell us that we have to start, using the Book of Common Prayer? All sorts of issues just pile up and create an anxious situation in which Michael Hall has written this wonderful book, a biography of Increase Mather, calling
That's
him
right.
the last Puritan. And so Increase Mather is the great figure to lead them in through this crisis as the last Puritan.
Now,
and so I take that and say, Cotton's the first evangelical.
Yeah.
I notice you haven't mentioned King Philip's War, which is occurring starting in the late 1670s. Joe Lepore and scholars since her in the last 10 to 15 years have made a great deal of King Philip's War and its influence upon New England, and particularly even upon the Salem witch trials. Does your silence about that indicate skepticism?
No. King Philip's War is a very tight war. First of all, there's the larger Indian context, which is huge. I mean, and Increase Cotton Mather becomes, you know, he's the lead figure for what's called the New England Company, which is Boston, New England's hope of having good relations with the Indians is all tied up in the New England Company, and Boston is and Cotton Mather's the leader of this for decades. And so, you know, Cotton's right at the center of this he sees it as a missionary endeavor, you know, building churches, Cotton learns Indian languages and stuff like this. On the other hand, though, is this Cotton Mather is in college at Harvard when the King Philip's War happens. And King Philip's War is this absolutely devastating war that destroys lots of things. But it actually fits in very tightly. I can't give you the exact month and stuff it started, but it's like starts in an April, I think, and ends just a few months later, you know, in that summer of, I think, 1675, I think it
is. As historians, we're lousy at dates. I just want to point that out to the audience.
And I'm an intellectual historian too. But the thing is, when I was writing the biography, it was very interesting for Cotton himself. He's a young kid, you know, he's like 12, 13 or so at Harvard at this time. Harvard gets actually shut down, but it's actually shut down before the King's Philip's War. And Increase and Mather's involved in everything, of course, at this point, trying to negotiate and write about all these things. But he's trying to save Harvard, and Cotton Mather's part of this Saving Harvard project. And the Saving Harvard project was, you know, in response to, in some ways, we've got to open the doors of Harvard, even though we've had this King Philip's War go on.
Was there any effect on Cotton's consciousness by King Philip's War? Because that's the suggestion, that New Englanders saw King Philip's War as, some sort of psychic break. That it might be a sign. It's a sign of God's wrath. Does Cotton take that on? Does he believe that in subsequent years?
You know, Cotton doesn't do that kind of stuff. He's not. He hasn't preached these things called Jeremiah. He preaches a lot, so he might have preached a few of them. But the thing is that he's not a wrath and hellfire type of guy looking for what God's mad at. This is what makes him an evangelical. He's much more sort of like positive. But on the other hand, with the Indian issue is, okay, in my book, I do talk about when the Indians attack Schenectady, New York, and that is in, 1689. This is right after they've overthrown the government of Boston, and you have a provisional governor, which is Simon Bradstreet. They have a dinner party at Samuel Sewall's house. William Stoughton is there, John Richards there. I mean, everybody who's of any importance is there. Cotton Mather is there as a young guy because he brings his mother, and they have this dinner table conversation in which they have to figure out what to do. And basically Samuel Sewall and Cotton Mather come out of it as the two who are most interested in creating good relations with the Indians. The only way we're going to be saved from having what happened to Schenectady happen to Boston is that we create better Indian relations. And so Cotton Mather becomes the sort of leader throughout the rest of his life for better Indian relations.
Okay, so yeah, go ahead.
It's hugely important. Now, many people would see him as a failure in this because he's not real good at seeing. He wants to get Indian relations so that they're not Catholic. He wants them Protestant. He wants to turn them into British-like people. And so he isn't a great visionary for our modern sensibility of helping Indians save their own culture. But he is very much intense upon building an Indian relationship, which his father's generation and his grandfather's generation had completely failed on.
Yeah. Yeah. Next, I guess let's tackle the Glorious Revolution. This is occurring 10 years. New England has been welded together somewhat haphazardly in 1685 into the Dominion of New England under James II and the governorship of Sir Edmund Andros, who usually heads the bad boys list in any popular history of colonial America. At least certainly
one of these fun interpretive issues. This is on these bad boy lists is Andros, but if you look at what Andros actually did, he's actually pretty compromising, and he's pretty good. he's pretty good. But the on the other hand is the perception of Andros by the people of Boston was built on paranoia. There wasn't anything Andros could do that could make this thing work out better. So
what was the paranoia directed at? One thing would be, of course, the creation of an Anglican church.
The bringing of an Anglican church, but then also just property rights. I mean, just simple, like, what if you had a government, all of a sudden it's for several years is telling you, hey, you may or you may not actually own your property.
Yeah, that won't go.
And you see, and Andros can't give them the answer they want to hear. And it's a situation fraught with problems.
So because of this, Increase secretly departs for London to negotiate directly with the king's government over a charter.
Yes. Well, it's one of those complicated things, because the Glorious Revolution actually happens in England after Increase gets there. So the king that Increase thought he was going to go talk to was James II. But by the time he's over there, you know, he's got to talk to William and Mary. And so there's a whole transition there. And Increase believes that he's really got the ear of William. And he has great faith in that for the rest of his life, or at least till William dies.
And the Glorious Revolution has enormous effects throughout all of colonial America, I mean, as it does, obviously, in England as well. How
empire is completely different now, and it's in the mindset. Like Tommy Kidd writes this great book called "The Protestant Interests," which is that the Protestant interest has been secured by William, and then eventually, once the Hanovers come in with George I, it's fully secured. Cotton Mather fits perfectly into this breath of fresh air that the Puritans don't need to be so fearful anymore. We now have William. William will look out for us. They'll take care of us. And then the Protestant issues will be developed better. So a great feeling of confidence comes with William and Mary that wasn't there under James II.
Or even Charles II, for that matter.
Yeah. They didn't know what was going to happen to him.
Yeah. Well, especially, I guess, arguably, because they knew that James would inherit. But so the charter controversy is over. You said that Mather's behaving as Thomas Jefferson during this crisis. I'd also point out that, which is interesting, but I also point out that in New York, which undergoes a rebellion even more active rebellion almost simultaneously, the leader of that rebellion is executed, even under William and Mary, Jacob Leisler. What sets apart, why do they survive? Why aren't they punished? How does Cotton Mather act as the sort of leader of the rebellion while his father is in England?
You know, this is one of the great, great fun, you know, questions. You know, we should sit around a coffee shop and just have a great one with this. Because, you know, here's the great issue of Cotton Mather's life, is that the diary for both this revolution in Boston and the witch trials is gone. That's out of the multi volumes of his diary, that's the one that's gone. Well, why is it gone? Well, that would be the one that says the most dangerous stuff in it. Many people say, oh, he would have said things, you know, in the witch trial things. Well, maybe, but more likely is he destroyed it, or someone in the family destroyed it. His kids marries into the Hutchinson family and stuff like that. That's a loyalist family that they don't want Cotton's really political ideas to be spewed about, especially his the ideas of during this period of the Glorious Revolution in Boston. So Cotton, it's very speculative. What we have is that we know Cotton became a speechwriter for Governor Bellamont, who comes over and one of their after the witch trials, and it's all one of these guys who's really settling things down. And we know before he was a speechwriter, he had been heavily involved at the highest levels of being a spokesman for Bradstreet and this provisional government. And it appears, and this is where David Levin, who wrote a biography of Cotton Mather, a Stanford professor, he writes a very good article about comparing Cotton Mather's statements and the things that he wrote that were to be published to calm down this glorious revolution in Boston, and comparing him with Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. And they're like straight across. So much of the basic ideas of the Declaration of Independence are fully articulated by Cotton Mather. And then when you add into it that Cotton Mather then writes this Magnalia Christi Americana, which has these biographies of Bradstreet and Phipps and all these political biographies in which he articulates more fully in there the ideas of what Thomas Jefferson has about taxation without representation, about all this sort of stuff. Cotton Mather is really very much a person who articulates the values of the American Revolution long before. And that's the diary that's gone. You know, that's the one that we want to see. And oh my, you know, that's a job for a novelist, you know?
Yeah.
So Phipps, Phipps hasn't arrived yet. In the midst of this sort of, I don't know what you call it, interregnum under these series of governors, we've got the events that we now refer to as the Salem Witch Trials. Give us your summary of those.
Okay, boy. this is, you know, when you get into it, this is where Cotton really gets wrongly portrayed for so many years. First of all, back 4-6 years before Salem witch trials, there's a witch trial in Boston, and what it is that these Goodwin children have been possessed, and a woman is caught, and she's convicted of witchcraft, and young Cotton Mather, who's just a kid at this time, he's in his early 20s, he writes a sort of journalistic account of this situation. And it's a great story of the pastors gather together to pray, and then the judges do their witch trial thing in Boston. And this is a woman it's a very interesting story. But the woman is doing, apparently, witchcraft. She's got little puppets and does she never recants. She sort of admits and declares these things in the courtroom that they just, you know, almost the judges can't do anything but execute her. But Cotton Mather is simply the journalist sort of about this. And then he takes one of the girls, Martha Goodwin, into his house. And he and his wife, Abigail, are just this, they believe in healthy living. And so they believe in, let's have a good diet for the child and give her water, make sure she sleeps enough, look out for her so she does chores and has an active social life. And if they can regularize her life while they all are praying for her, then she can be healed. And so Cotton Mather becomes the sort of thinkus of himself as a guy who can really sort of handle witch situations, because he can be the one who can sort of help these women get healed. Now, he writes this. This is his first great famous work that gets published all over England and stuff. And so he becomes the sort of witchcraft writer with that book. Yeah.
He'd be on the cable shows.
Yeah, he's got credibility. All right, so then let's jump, you know, 6-8 years later to 92, when the witch trial starts in Salem. 1692 is the witch trials in Salem. And what happens there is the first thing that we are told by Cotton's son that he did was Cotton recommended that the girls who were being afflicted all be separated and all be sent to homes where you know, they would be looked after, you know, given a good diet, make sure they're sleeping right, you know, all that sort of stuff. And if you separate them all, he felt that we could all heal the girls. That was his main interest, in healing the girls.
That would have been a very good thing if that had happened.
Right. It would have solved everything right from the beginning. But the judges, a separate court, a special court under William Stoughton is created, and they go a little overboard, okay, and they go wild. Now, Cotton respects these guys. William Stoughton's like his father's cohort. You know, Cotton Mather is not a rabble-rouser. He's a very respectful person for his elders and his father's friends. And so his father's friends, and Samuel Sewell was his tutor in college, and so he respects Samuel Sewell, all these guys who are judges. So he writes them a letter. John Roberts is actually the guy who gets the letter, is a parishioner of his. And he writes in the letter, okay, here's what is the criteria for convicting a witch. And it has to be a confession. Spectral evidence and all the other evidence that can be presented is all circumstantial. And then he does the standard thing, which is very commonsensical, which is, you know, you don't want to execute someone wrongly. So it's better to be lenient than to be overly punitive. And so, therefore, his position is that you can't convict a person until they confess. Now, the fun of this is that when witches do confess in the trials, they confess and then they ask forgiveness and they're given forgiveness, and so they're not executed. And so if the way Cotton had lined it out in this letter had been followed, there would have been no executions. There would have been, you know, just maybe the one of Giles Gorey, I don't know, you know, where he gets piled. That's a different situation. But
The fellow who refuses to...
And so they have to pile. That's an old English thing where they pile.
It's an old, yeah. I mean, the English always like to say there's no torture under English common law, but there actually is. You get rocks piled on you if you refuse to make either a guilty or an innocent plea. So.
Yeah. It's chaos. That's the thing about the dang witch trials. It's chaos. But if Cotton and his father and the local ministers had been followed, their advice, none of this chaos of the witch trials would have happened. So the idea that the ministers are somehow behind this is the great falsity. And that's what later on in the 19th century and the 20th century, they've sort of twisted the whole story. Cotton becomes the lead weirdo of a bunch of ministers who all want to, so it becomes an anti-religion thing.
We'll get to that in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
But Robert, how do you pronounce his last name? I've never actually said it out loud. C-A-L-E-F. There you go. Okay. I
can't pronounce it either. Frankly, I don't know. We don't know whether it's Mather or Mather.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's what we know. You wrote a whole biography of him, and you don't even know how to pronounce his name. What kind of doctor are you? Caliph is where a lot of the stories start. And many of our perceptions of Cotton Mather begin with him. Well, how does he describe Mather and all of this?
Yeah, you know, Caliph is this guy that is very much an enigma. You know, people have tried to figure out who he is and what he is. You know, they've done a lot to try and find him. But basically, he's somebody who just hates the Mathers. He hates the ministers. He perceives himself to be some sort of leading rationalist, and apparently he's got a group of friends, but, you know, even Thomas Brattle and stuff don't show any sort of, there's parallels between them, but he doesn't, you know, the Brattles don't, and Leverett, they don't have letters to him or any evidence of being associated with him. This is a guy who wants to spread bad information. And so he makes up stories, he takes stories, he exaggerates stories. He just really creates a mess, and he finally publishes them in 1700 or 1701 in London. He can't get them published in America. And so Cotton has to deal with this his whole life, this guy spreading horrible stories.
What these are the sort of this is the big incident for when people discuss Cotton Mather. This is what has turned him into a Marvel Comics villain. I'm happy I did not know that before. so I don't have a big L on my forehead. Marvel Comics villain who slays witches, which is apparently villainous in Marvel Comics. Witches are good, I guess. I don't know. But you would want us to focus on other aspects of Mather's life. He's still going to be a controversialist for the rest of his life. There's the whole smallpox inoculations controversy.
Yeah.
Describe that just before we move on to the sort of the actual sort of everyday details of his life.
1723, yeah. I think, or something.
And a hand grenade gets thrown into his house, crying out loud. I mean,
yeah, I know. I should have actually brought a timeline with dates, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, we're skipping forward from
Zooms here for these dates. Yeah. But this is a very interesting story because the scientific guys who are following what we would consider the more experimental scientific sort of Royal Society way of thinking, those guys, those doctors are saying inoculation is horrible. This is a way of killing a person, is to actually inoculate them with the virus already. Cotton Mather hears a story from his slave, who he believes is Onesimus. He's a good slave. It's about how Africans in their tribes, and there's some sort of background to Onesimus. Onesimus had seen where people had been inoculated, and then, being a reader, and this is the way Cotton does science. He's mainly a reader of science. He had read about inoculations and experiments in inoculations by these European guys, and so Cotton Mather goes, okay, here's African and European support for the idea of a inoculation, so let's give it a go. And he does it to his family and to friends of his family. And I mean, this is a dire situation. I mean, people are dying right and left, and so anything, you know, is worth the risk. And Cotton Mather defends his inoculations on the basis of what we would call sort of testimony of because Cotton Mather ultimately is a very trusting person, and he trusts these documents, and he trusts this slave to tell him the truth. And so that's how he stands for inoculation. And in fact, that's the way most people do science in the world, is actually through this kind of level of trust and the trusting of books and stuff. And so Cotton Mather comes out ahead in this, even though the scientific minds, the doctors and stuff. And so his inoculation issue is his promotion of inoculation is considered sort of one of the great moments in medical science. Now, just as a note, though, Cotton had been doing medicine all of his life, and as a pastor, he considered himself both a doctor of souls and bodies, and so he did both together. And so he was quite the medical expert in town, and considered.
And of course, dabbled in law. This is welcome to colonial America, where no one does just one job.
That's right.
So what's his daily life? I mean, we also say that he seems to have suffered, graphoria, I guess, along with Martin Luther. Yeah, he has very few unwritten thoughts, as one of my professors said about one of his professors. I mean, this Biblia Americana that you're working on, what is – I don't think I'd ever heard of it. It's 10 volumes long but unpublished?
Here, let me just make an analogy. I've been noticing in our modern computer age that I usually have two or three students, or there's actually some faculty on campus that carry around with them a sort of journal. And so you have this verb that's created called journaling, and there are people who find great solace in just writing down their thoughts and writing. It's sort of talking to themselves through writing. And so Cotton Mather does that a lot. And then he also publishes little sermons, he's writing sermons all the time, and he likes to publish his sermons, and frankly, there's a big market for them. And so there's publishers at the door after he preaches saying, okay, can I have that one to publish? So he's you know, like got what 700 or something titles out there of books he's written. And so he's got a lot of he just writes a lot of stuff. And then he actually is what we would call in this commonplace book tradition. It's a tradition in which when you read something that was meaningful to you, you would actually copy out the whole passage in your own book. So this is a guy who spends maybe, you know, his every evening after dinner and just writing in his books, and he's either copying something or his own thoughts, or his, and then the diary is the most fascinating book in colonial America, Cotton Mather's diary, because it's not a diary, it's something he compiles on birthdays every year, and from notes, and so, you know, he just is a scribbler. He just can't stop writing.
So what he writes Magnalia Christi Americana, which is published, and that's like a doorstop in and of itself.
Hey, but when that came out, that impressed. You cannot be not impressed when you pick up this book. This is a book full of all of his own original research. It's also full of other stuff he copies. He has biographies. He thinks of himself as Plutarch, putting together biographies of public figures and ministers. He has a history of Harvard in there. He has a history of the Indian Wars. He has a history of missionary activity.
We should do a separate podcast actually on that book, because it's actually when
that is the most amazing book published for America, I think, before the war, the Revolutionary War. And the thing is that with that book, he becomes, he's the greatest scholar. So this is where, you know, all of the legislature wants to, you know, 100% of the unanimous decision by the assembly to name Cotton Mather president of Harvard. And, you know, he gets thwarted from that. But the thing is, he has this amazing popularity, not only for his own piety, not only for his family line, but his own scholarship. It's just amazing to the whole colony. And so he becomes this great leader.
We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left in the podcast, so I want to we've just begun to touch a lot of the things that I wanted to touch upon, but you mentioned earlier Michael Hall's book on Increase Mather, The Last Puritan, The Last American Puritan. You've chosen very consciously to call your book The First American, Cotton Mather's The First American Evangelical. What do you mean by that?
Well, sort of glittering generalities, I guess. But at one level, there isn't really any definition of Puritan, nor is there any clear one definition of evangelical. But a major transformation happens where Puritan fades out and evangelicalism starts. And usually evangelicalism is heavily rooted in the Great Awakening, which happens, you know, 15 years or so after Cotton Mather's dead. And what I do is show that a lot of the great issues of the evangelical awakening that is in this great awakening, the ideas of looking to your minister for piety and then giving grant to the Holy Spirit its full power to do what it needs to do, and a real trust in God, a real prayerful life, a dedication to biblical living. These things all appear very clearly in Cotton Mather. And then the link for me is that is at the end of my book, I point out that when Cotton died, his son immediately published a life, a biography of Cotton Mather. But what it is a cut-up of, it's mostly cut up from the diary of Cotton Mather. And then it was published in England in another version, published in America. It was widely spread around. Everyone in the Connecticut Valley is reading it, you know, all the Williamses and stuff, the Jonathan Edwards family, you know, they're all reading Cotton Mather's diary. And that biography by Samuel Mather really does sort of present an evangelical pastor. It's. I think that diary is one of the most neglected things in American literature as an evangelical spiritual document. It certainly has been read by hundreds, and all the scholars read it, but they usually read it with some sort of like psychological bent, trying to figure out who is this guy. But on the other hand, is if you read it as a sort of like a model of, you know, follow me while I follow Christ, which is the way Cotton Mather thought, you know, it's a powerful, powerful story of or model of what becomes the evangelical way of thinking.
Finally, briefly, some historians regard historical biographies, as a sort of second best kind of history. You've now done both the real kind of history, and you've done this biography. What are your thoughts on historical biography as a sort of a historical a genre of historical writing?
I am a follower of the father of history, Herodotus. When Herodotus wrote, talked about history as being really about stories of people and the decisions people make and the complexity of how decisions get made. Herodotus presents the Persian wars as based upon Darius's wife telling him, "Hey, you're getting a little fat. You shouldn't go conquer someplace." So these little things, you know, and so the situation of the geography, the situation of who your family is, the situation of what makes a person is at the core of what makes history history. And so to me, biography is at the very center of history. I've always thought it's the most fun history to read, and then also at the same time, it's the kind of history which, frankly, you know, how are we going to understand, you know, foreign policy or other sort of things without understanding the people who are doing it? And so I'm a big believer in biography.
My guest has been Rick Kennedy. His book is The First American Evangelical, A Short Life of Cotton Mather. It's from the Library of Religious Biography, published by William B. Erdmans, in which several influential volumes, including Alan Gweltso's Redeemer President, Life of Abraham Lincoln, have been published in this series. And I hope, Rick, that you have the same kind of success that Gweltso had.
Yeah, well, I hope so, too. Alan's a great guy.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay. Bye.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.